Welcome to Magic the Flavouring, the Magic Gathering podcast, where we talk about all things magic, flavour design and lore. I'm your host, Andy Mann, and what a show we've got today. We have Michelle Rapp of the Loregoifs and one of the Tour de Forces of the Vorthos world coming in to talk about their favourite online fiction, The Flood by Alison Lures, one of the most impressive stories in magic fiction, and indeed one of the linchpin individual story articles from the fabulous Ixalan block of online fiction. It's one of mine and Nathan's favourite stories. I think we've always talked about that, so I'm very, very excited to get them on the show and to go through that storyline. Before we do, though, just wanted to talk about another story that I'm really excited to kind of revisit, or at least story setting that I'm excited to revisit this year. And obviously we'll talk about it more when we get to it, but that is Dominaria United. And I'm not that fussed about Dominaria in general. Like, I understand it's like Magic's like first plane, but obviously coming into the game a little bit later when Dominaria wasn't quite as relevant, I don't think it holds as much weight to me as it does other people who play this game. What I will say, though, the thing I'm really excited about, and it's something that might not come to pass, but I hope it does, is the reintroduction of the new Weatherlight crew under Captain Joira. So that's Joira, Tiana, Shana, Raph, Arvad, and Slimefoot. And the reason this has popped into my head is, A, talking about the Flood and Ixalan block with Michelle. Dominaria was the set of stories directly after Ixalan, so if you're really invested in the Amonkhet Ixalan stories, then moving straight into Dominaria with Martha Wells at the helm of these stories at that point. I mean, everything leading up to War of the Spark, and indeed Nikki Drayden's Ravnica stories, which we will also talk about with Michelle a little bit. That was a peak era for Magic Online fiction, before the books that I'd rather not talk about. But also because I this week built a new EDH deck. I got kind of bored and a little bit sick and tired of not having new to build, and I had a bunch of lands in my box that I wanted to use. Like, everyone knows I've been trying to build a Simic deck, but an Azorius deck is also something I've been trying to look at. I'm not a big control player, so tricky colours for me. But I picked up Raph Capuchin, Ship's Mage, which has been, I mean, it's just been in my bits box for the longest time, and I was desperately trying to find a way to make Lavinia Azorius Renegade work, because I love the promo art on it. Very apt for New Capenna. Storyline out, by the way, for New Capenna. Not going to talk about it now. It's excellent. Go read it. We'll talk about it next week. And I just had this kind of flash of inspiration. Flash. Yeah, okay. That wasn't intended. And yeah, I just got reminded by the whole new Dominaria crew. They were so well realized as a group, and they just seemed like a really nice, fresh introduction of like an adventuring party or adventuring crew that wasn't the Gatewatch. By this point in the story, the Gatewatch had pretty much been like kaput by Bolas up at the end of Amonkhet block. But this new group trying to like resurrect the Weatherlight and save Dominaria in those little Dominaria stories, they were so well balanced, and each one of them had such a great story. Especially you had like Arvad, the black white vampire, who, being part of the Banalish Church, like didn't want to, you know, give in to his vampiric tendencies. You had Tiana, an angel who didn't feel like they had a purpose and then found their purpose with the power stone, the soul of the Weatherlight. You know, Shana, Cisse, who's a descendant of Captain Cisse, trying to live up to that legacy under the captainship of Joira. You had Raph Capuchin, who, knowing he came from the Capuchin line, wasn't the first pick from the Capuchin line in that story. His sister Danitha Capuchin was. So he has to prove himself as a worthy member of the crew, and being a mage who is maybe less focused and less disciplined than a lot of his magical peers is like a really nice idea. And then you have Slimefoot, a fungus which grew in on the Weatherlight from the wood made of the Weatherlight, and is just kind of there. It's just such a great little group of characters. And when we go back to Dominaria United, I hope they graduate from having uncommon legendary creature cards into full-blown rare or even mythic rare creature cards. I don't know if that'll happen because they're obsessed with cycles. But I do hope we see them again, and I hope we see an evolution of their storyline, because I would happily have like a side, like a continuing set of side stories where we just follow the new crew of the Weatherlight around. And hey, you know, with all this temporal gate technology and planar bridge technology and everything else that's going on right now in the multiverse, with people seemingly being able to jump from plane to plane at will. You don't need to be a planeswalker anymore. Maybe we'll see the Weatherlight get some of that tech. Who knows? One can dream. All right. Here's my talk with Michelle. Wonderfully special guest on the show with us. We have the amazing Vorthos extraordinaire, I'm going to say, Michelle Rapp. Good morning, good afternoon, Michelle.
Good morning on my end. Hello. Thank you so much for having me. So yes, as you probably heard, I am Michelle Rapp. You may or may not have heard of my old podcast, which is currently on hiatus, The Loregoifs, where we do basically sort of a sketch comedy reinterpretation, I think is a charitable way of putting it, of a magic story as it was coming out. Yes, I mentioned we're on hiatus, but I also do yammer a bit on Twitter, where you find at Kiln Fiend Potter, where I deliver a lot of, I like to call, responsibly spicy takes on on lore and also just the world. And I just am known as being that, I suspect in the cast of characters that is the magic community, I'm just that old lady like in the window just waving her like frying pan at things and just yelling at people.
Yeah, but
in
it's
the
not
street.
It's not like the magic community doesn't give you enough to wave your frying pan at. It's not you going looking for arguments.
No.
The arguments are there to be had. Don't sell yourself short.
Oh yeah, to be fair, yes. I mean, it's as if it's not like I prefer to wave my frying pan around. I'd rather, I don't know, make some flapjacks or something in that frying pan. I'd rather, you know, do some like eggs over easy, maybe make some bacon, just make like a full breakfast for people with that frying pan, rather than like, I don't know, take it outside and wave it at people with droplets of bacon fat just flying in the wind. Like, that's just not, I don't think anyone wants me to do that. I don't want to do that. I'd rather be making a sumptuous feast for people. But
oh, for sure.
Yes, yeah, such is life.
Such is life. I mean, the Loregoifs got up to, I was checking this morning, I wanted to see how many episodes you guys got up to. I mean, you stopped at around the time of Kaldheim, I think. You were at about 152 episodes.
Yes, we were. Wow. We were for a really long time. I mean, we had been, honestly, I think so. What happened was, what really broke our spirits is really War of the Spark and Forsaken. We were following the lore for years. I believe we started right around Kaladesh, if not before. And we were having a grand old time just like going through, watching the Gatewatch get into all sorts of shenanigans. It was absolutely hilarious and fun. And then, of course, we got Ixalan and just, that was so good. And then we head into the end game with War of the Spark and that whole fiasco. It was a bit like watching... Oh, gosh. Right. I was about to say like Tom Brady, but I'm like, oh, wait, no, I should probably say it's a bit like watching, I don't know, if David Beckham came back and sure, he was sure. Like, and they were like, here, have this ball. There is this goal. It's only 5 yards away. You could totally do it. It'd be as if he just picked up the ball with his hands and then just plunged a knife into that ball, threw that ball into the goal and then just dropped the knife and walked away.
We know who Tom Brady is. He's the football man. He's the quarterback. He's won a lot. And he's recently retired. Is that right?
He recently retired. Then he unretired himself because money.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. I mean, that is a fantastic way to put that, because there was such a good thing going with the online story before War of the Spark. And I mean, we're 102 episodes ourselves. And I think anyone who's listened to even a teeny bit of our podcast knows just how much we despise those books and just what they did to Magic Story. And it's only just the glimmer of hope is like there, like to recovery of what's going on.
Absolutely. And I mean, what really broke us was just honestly, for me personally, the not so great representation of Killian Liu in Strixhaven. And as soon as that came out, I remember just being like, you know what, we're done. I'm personally done. I need to take a break from this, because I'm not going just to sit here and like have to like read things that actively offend me. It's not something that I would like to do with my time. So I ended up just taking a bit of a break. I skipped Strixhaven entirely because that was just not something I wanted to do with myself. I did a bit of a lore recap with Little Gritty Run. But other than that, you know, I've been just sort of looking at lore from afar. I'm finally getting back into it with now Kamigawa,
mm-hmm.
Previous sets as well, and now New Capenna is coming, which is exciting.
Well, it's today it's dropped. I actually literally just as I hit the record button, so this will date people for the episode that I did release today, which was the previous one I did with Total MTG. I did a little preamble. I recorded that today, and now this is going to be coming out weeks later, so people might get confused. But I literally just got a message from Nathan saying, New Capenna story. So as we're talking, once we get off this call, the first episode will be there for us to read.
I feel like they're the only appropriate way to announce that news is if Nathan was also in a newsy cap with some suspenders with some knickerbockers on and just a big sheaf of newspapers under his hand, just like New Capenna story.
I'm still thinking that that's how they're going to try and get sagas into this set. They're going to do sagas as like newspaper reels, like that's how they're going to present them on the card.
I would adore that. I would love to come back for a New Capenna discussion, but like the art during this time period is so fascinating. There were actually quite a few murals being put up. Like Diego Rivera actually was being highly contracted around the United States at the time and the world, creating these amazing murals that depicted especially that highlighted labor and laborers, and it was just really, really amazing. So
yeah, I mean, from an art perspective, I'm massively looking forward to it. I mean, my knowledge of American art in terms of our real world rather than Magic the Gathering world kind of starts and ends with Mark Rothko, because I'm a big Rothko fan. And that's like a decade and a bit later, do you know what I mean? So it's not quite the same going on. So I'm absolutely up for seeing like a culture that is, because being from the UK, like we are cousins in terms of Americans and the British, but like it is still such a different upbringing, if you like, in terms of
absolutely
style. And so I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, no, and then there were just a ton of things also coming from Germany with the Weimar Republic and that whole influence coming in. I mean, sure, we did have a lot of Art Deco, and I'm certain that will be the main artistic theme of the set, but I'm hoping that we get like a little bit of Diego Rivera. I'm hoping that we're gonna get a little bit of like other art styles like Art Nouveau or whatever, but it'll be I think very interesting. I think some of the brutalist movement came out of this too, so there's some really cool like art history that's gonna get dropped. And given how deep they cut in the art design for Kamigawa Neon Dynasty, I am ecstatic to see what's gonna happen here.
Like, it's going to be fantastic. I mean, you yourself, your profession, your trade is that you're a ceramicist, you're a potter, right?
I am a potter. I am, as my Twitter name does indicate, I am a potter. I also did take a couple of classes in art history and also film noir. And I mean, as anyone who has studied media knows, I mean, even if you're studying literature or just the visual arts or even music, everything bleeds into one another, right?
Yeah, for sure.
In terms of expression. So it is going to be really cool, I think, to see how this part of history is going to be interpreted, because there, and I think it's also going to be like, I think the first very directly American set, which as an American, I'm like, this is going to be, it's going to be fascinating to see how we as a community interpret our myths and our legends and our fantasy, right?
Yeah, I mean, myths and legends for I suppose like North America is not they aren't the words that you would usually use to describe like American culture, like by like the kind of the stars and stripes culture, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, like, and this is extremely, it's going to be very starsy and stripesy, I think, not necessarily in terms of patriotism, but I think in terms of the American ideals and setting, like the greed, the naked greed that I think is very indicative of American capitalism in particular.
Oh, for sure. I mean, when Throne of Eldraine came out, and it was the kind of Arthurian like UK Isles mythology versus the kind of Germanic fairy tale legends, and it was just the realms were just this oppressive like system of royalty and kingdoms and stuff like that. We didn't come out looking the most squeaky clean, although it was kind of, you had the gloss, the glaze of of like high fantasy, I suppose. So this being a bit more like of a contemporary take on it, following Kamigawa, I suppose, is going to be, yeah, it's going to be real cool. It's going to be great.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating. I'm so looking forward to it, especially since a lot of the mafia stories here in the United States are so linked also to the immigrant story. Mm. So I wonder how that's going to be interpreted as well. It's going to be a whole thing.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, we're discussing today. I mean, I would love to talk.
Well, we just talk about Kamigawa and Kapena.
But we've got to talk about what I think when we were messaging each other setting up this interview, we both described as the golden age of story of MTG online fiction. And that is the Ixalan story arc, written entirely, save for the very last kind of multiple choice ending episode, written entirely by Alison Lurz, who at the time was working with Wizards of the Coast.
Oh, she's still Wizards of the Coast. She is just, she's no longer working in this particular department. She is now working in world building. In like design, and she's just on another team. It's cool. She's just another team.
Oh, there we go. Oh, good. Well, that's good to hear. I mean, I wish, as much as I do appreciate actually a lot of the authors that they've brought in to take kind of like outside eye views on the story, and it's some of them play Magic and some of them don't, but I do sort of miss the days of where they had the in-house team. You know, you had Kelly Diggs writing stories, and I think Kelly Diggs and Greg Lubin both had contributions for the particular episode that we're talking about today.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, they did. They definitely, you can see Greg's editing style all over this. Kelly is just a font of knowledge. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but it is also very distinctly Alison Lurz.
So 100%. This whole story arc, I mean, there's about 13, 14 episodes in total, which, you know, because they had the two sets for the Ixalan block. This is pre-War of the Spark, for anyone who's kind of a little bit sort of hazy on where this kind of fits in. This is Jace after the fall of Amonkhet. The end of Amonkhet happens where Bolas defeats the Gatewatch and completely annihilates them, and Jace is whisked away with his mind seemingly broken with an induced amnesia to the plane of Ixalan. It's the first time we ever saw Ixalan, and we have the main protagonists of Vraska, who's the captain of the Belligerent at the time, and an amnesiac Jace, with the antagonists or seeming antagonists of Kamena, of who's a merfolk, who's kind of the antagonist force in this story, at least up to a point anyway.
I mean, it's tricky to necessarily pin down who is evil and who is who is bad or who is good, I suppose, is the best way of going about it, because I think the closest might actually be like the conquistadors, and even then there's a little bit of nuance there. Alenda.
Alenda themselves as a character didn't like what the Dusk Rose was doing. I mean, so
she is the Dusk Rose. She didn't like what Vona was doing.
Oh, that's true. Very true. Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're getting into it. So the story we're talking about specifically today, if you couldn't have told by the title of this episode as you're reading as it comes out, is The Flood, which is the eighth episode in this story arc. So yeah, 8 of 13. And again, yeah, written by Alison Lurz, with contributions from Greg Lubin and Kelly Diggs. This was released January 10th, 2018.
Oh, Four years ago. Oh God, I remember exactly where I was when I was reading this story. I was taking a lunch break from my communal studio at the time. I was in the middle of, I think, several commissions, and I remember like the feel of like clay still on my hands, even though I had washed them a couple of times. And I'd gone across the street for lunch, and because I am such a freaking bougie person, I had an acai bowl. I had an acai bowl and some water, and I was reading this on my phone, and I just remember, like, at some point, no longer eating my acai bowl. It's just, like, slowly melting in the California sun, and I'm just, like, weeping over my phone. I remember, like, tears getting into my acai bowl and being like, yeah, this is so beautiful.
I mean, this is the story. So when I asked you I publicly called you out on Twitter, because that's just how I get people's attention. And we're like, oh, I'd love to hear what Michelle Rapp's viewpoints on storyline is. And then obviously you popped up and you were very happy to come on. And I asked you which story episode it would be to do a book club episode, because I think, you know, there's so much negativity in the magic space, or so much things that we just have to feel like we combat all the time. I wanted to talk about something which we both enjoyed and liked and could just be actively positive about, because, you know, it's a much nicer experience sometimes. And you suggested The Flood, this specific episode. And as soon as you said it, I knew exactly what story it was. I knew exactly what happened. I think I even remembered roughly what the date it came out was, because one of my personal favorites as well. And I was just,
What were you doing while I was crying into my fruit bowl?
So I read this. I think this must have been, I can't remember specifically, but I read all of these stories on my commutes in and out of my job at the time. So I think I was must have been on a train. And I read all these Ixalan stories on the train. I do distinctly remember doing that. And just being so invested in the characterization of Raska specifically. Because honestly, I'm not the hugest Jace fan. And I think at the time I was maybe on a little bit of fatigue of the Gatewatch hype. Although I loved the fact that at the end of the Amonkhet storyline, they lost. So that was like a big like, oh shit, they're going to be doing something real interesting. But I just remember, especially with this, just seeing... We'll do the story breakdown in a second, but just seeing the vulnerability from Vraska's characterization and just, yeah. It's being utterly blown away that this could be a magic story. This is a story for our card game. Like, it's wild. Wild to me.
It is. It's the height of it, because it shows what we could achieve. Mm-hmm. I think if the resources and the people are put, and the time are invested in it, I think we can... I don't know. We can have this happen again. I think it just needs the right team. It needs the right level of care. And
yeah, for sure.
And I'm optimistic looking at current magic story. But as you said, we should focus on this thing because it's so freaking good, right?
It's really good. So what I'll do then, everyone who's ever listened to a book club episode has heard me do this, or indeed the larger story breakdowns when we break down an entire story arc from one of the most recent sets. I'm going to try and give a very brief blow-by-blow account of what happens in this story episode, and try and be as succinct as possible. Obviously, there's going to be some context here for people who maybe haven't read any of the Ixalan story arc. There might be things in here where you're just like, I have no idea what that is, aside from things you might have seen on cardboard. But that should just promote the idea that you need to go read this story arc, and indeed read the Amonkhet story arc as well. When we spoke to Anthony Tessitore, like, of his passion for the Amonkhet storyline, proved that you should probably go and read that as well. But the Ixalan is the one. So, okay, here we go. The Flood. We open with Kumena, the merfolk shaper, and as we said, sort of protagonist of this, antagonist, sorry, of this storyline, finally arriving at the golden city of Araska and effectively winning the race between the different factions of Ixalan who are trying to get to this holy city the quickest. And he is drawn in by the MacGuffin of the storyline, the Immortal Sun, as he's hearing whispers in his head to find the chamber which this Mortal Sun resides in. He discovers when he arrives at the Immortal Sun that the power of this artifact amplifies the magic held by the wielder. But before he can fully claim it, the vampires, Vona, Butcher of Magan, and Mavrin Vane of the Legion of the Dusk Rose arrive to attack him, ending in Kumena being thrown out of a window.
Yes, Vona just yeets him out the window, which is amazing because it's at the very pinnacle of this of this enormous palace and like mountain. So it's just... You can imagine the Foley like woo,
this is immediately a detour. I just love the fact that the power of the Immortal Sun is fought over so like readily, and just like there is no winner, like there can never be a winner of it, and no one ever really comes out on top. Like, no matter, there's, I think at a different point in each like of the preceding stories, of the following stories, there's a different person who gets the power of the Immortal Sun, and they can never hold on to it for more than a second. I just love that. It's great.
Yeah.
We then cut to Jace and Vraska on a riverbank near the city. Jace in the previous story has just fallen over the top of a waterfall, and due to his fall and physical trauma has unlocked all of the psychic barriers that have held much of his life's memory hidden until this point. During this arc, Jace has also been suffering from amnesia brought on by the Gatewatch's defeat by Bolas on Amonkhet, and Jace has had his memory tampered with and wiped by many people in his life, including himself. So this is just the latest in a long line of amnesiac spells for Jace. Vraska, who is trying to revive Jace, is immersed in the memories that come flooding psychically back to Jace's mind, and she starts to see key moments from his life. Firstly, we travel to Zendikar and we see the wreckage of the Seagate. Then we jump to Jace's time in the Infinite Consortium and his torture at the hands of Tezzeret. We then move swiftly on to Jace's first visit to Ravnica and the origin of his iconic white tattoos, which were given to him by a Gruul shaman and seem to have some significance at that. At this point in the story, we're not quite sure, but it very quickly gets revealed. Next, we see a very loaded conversation on Innistrad between him and Liliana. Who, interesting that Vraska has never met Liliana before, because when Vraska's witnessing this memory, the point of view is the woman dressed in lilac, right? So she's never,
yeah, she's dressed in violet. And
violet,
she's
sorry,
like,
yeah. Like, so which whoa. it's interesting that you have these massive key characters and other characters. It's always great to see when people don't have all the information. Like, it's very natural dramatic irony rather than kind of forced sort of conflict, which is nice. The conversation on Innistrad seems to take place post Eldritch Moon, because Jace toasts to Emrakul doing their work for them. So that kind of places that in that little timeline. Then Jace's childhood is revealed on Vryn, all the way through to his climactic battle with his original tormentor, the Sphinx known as Alhamret, where we see a teenage Jace, I think around the age of 15, they say in the storyline, 13, 15, breaking the Sphinx's mind so completely in a psychic duel as to colour his self-perception and the actions that lead kind of to the rest of his life. He completely destroys Alhamret's mind to the point where Alhamret is nothing more than just like a fresh newborn being who has no comprehension of what it is to even be alive, which is a terrifying prospect. Lastly, we settle on Jace and his memories of Vraska. First, their recent happy memories as the crew of the Belligerent, then morphing into their first meeting as deadly enemies, where Vraska was intent on killing Jace during the events of Return to Ravnica Block. We then have Jace come back to the present once all these memories are flooded back to him, and Vraska starts to wonder how Jace will react to her knowing their full history, because up until this point, although Vraska is aware of what's happened between them and Jace, Jace wasn't, and they were kind of living in this, it's almost like little bubble of nothing else matters outside the world of Ixalan. So now that Jace remembers the fact that Vraska was trying to kill him the last time that they met, how would they interact? Thankfully, Jace being Jace and understanding how memory and life is a tricky thing, seemingly shows that their bond is now stronger than ever, and they have a deeper understanding of each other. And the past 3 months, he says, have been the best months of his life, which is clearly the response Vraska would have wanted. And then with most of Jace's memories restored, they head off to the Golden City of Araska for the plot to continue into Ixalan. Whew. I mean, what a story, right?
It's
wild.
It is one of the, I mean, first of all, I just want to say, like, one of the first things I love about this entire story arc is how fearless Allison was in her taking on not only what very well could have been an extremely cheesy arc. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've seen the amnesia thing done before, most notably in like your favorite soap operas, like the EastEnders or like Days of Our Lives.
Yeah.
It is very much like, or a telenovela, you know, mm-hmm. It is very much a story trope, and it could have been taken in a very blasé sort of way, but in this way, like, she chose to make this an opportunity to really investigate the true natures of these main characters. Mm-hmm. By making Jace so vulnerable, we not only learn about Jace, but we learn about Vraska as well, right? Because she's a very, you know, ride or die sort of person, but she's also extremely focused on the job. She's not a sadist. She's been contracted to come here, get the golden sun and to get out. Like, that's her thing. She's here to get the artifact. She's here to leave. And so seeing him like this, realizing that he has no memory of who she is, she's going to just be kind. Cause I mean, she doesn't really know what else to, I mean, this is what she decides to do with someone she once perceived as her enemy. Mm. And now, and I think that her decision to comfort Jace in his most painful psychological, emotional point is also a really brave choice, right? It's, and I think the reason why this story is so powerful is because it chooses to wrestle with a very dark and very deep topic, which is abuse and trauma. And not only does the story deal with it in a very empathetic way, it deals with it in a very kind and very resolved perspective, if that makes sense. Both characters choose to move on. I mean, not to move on from like their trauma, because of course it's never going to be something you can fully that comes with you. It's your baggage. You got to check it wherever you go. But I think that the decision to have to sort of digest that knowledge, to carry it with them, and then use that knowledge to, I guess, proceed with their lives is a powerful one. So it's a very deep, it's a very, very, very deep story.
I really love the way you talk about them proceeding with their lives, because it's the kind of thing with Jace where the very essence of this story is the fact that we are reminded, because this comes at a point in like magic fiction where a lot of Jace's backstory is kind of locked away behind a lot of the books that a lot of people might not have like access to, like, you know, like A Test of Metal and things like that. And so this story of Jace's memories coming flooding back, and the choice to have all these little scenes play out, reminds maybe fresh audiences, and indeed reminded me at the time, of all the different facets of his life, and the fact that he is a character that has always been in arrested development in a way, because of his own self-induced like memory loss, where he wipes his own mind throughout different story arcs, or other people wipe his mind for him. He can't have ever remembered his first planeswalk, because Elhammer used him as a planeswalking like agent, and then, you know, wiped his mind every time he came back. And it is, it's the realization that you are dealing with things that are maybe larger with yourself, but the kind of breathe out that you can finally start to deal with that in a healthy way. And the fact that Jace doesn't flip out and kind of attack Vraska or blame Vraska for not, you know, filling him in or any of this kind of thing, and just kind of realizing that it's just something he has to deal with, and that the past 3 months of their life together is just as valid and is just as real as any other part of their lives, is a really comforting thing to read. That, you know, it all matters. It's not just the bad stuff that can affect you, it's the good stuff as well, and the good stuff should be held aloft, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. And as, you know, Jace is having this immense Celine Dion moment, it's sort of it's also just amazing to see a very clearly male character, decidedly male, we're gonna go with decidedly male character choose to be so, I mean, I guess maybe not choose, but is in a vulnerable position. The fact that, and I think it's very I think it's very true what you said about being in a state of arrested development, because if we define human existence as a summation of all of our experiences, choosing to, or not choosing to, having those memories forcibly excised from your mind, I think robs you of your ability to grow and to evolve in a lot of ways to make yourself better. And I think this is also very indicative of the blue color philosophy if we're looking at the color pie. And that's another thing I love about this too. Oh my gosh, there's so many layers of the story. But like from a blue perspective, this is Jace as we have never seen Jace before. This is fully Jace.
Yeah.
Jace has all the information. Blue is all about about perfection and about making yourself better through knowledge. And if you don't have the full knowledge of yourself, like how on earth are you going to become a better version of yourself? You don't have all the tools you need. And so now that he has all that information, he is able to make those decisions. And again, like you said, it's wonderful that he chooses to trust Vraska based on the past 3 months. Like he chooses to move forward. This is what it means to survive abuse. You deliberately make that choice to look at, you know, what happened to you, and to decide what those next steps are for yourself and to have those next steps be a healthy choice.
Yeah.
Maybe literally, maybe in this case, it means you literally has got to climb up like a bajillion stairs to get to the top of this freaking.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is the area of sexy Jace, isn't it? Where he was like,
stupid sexy Jace.
he's all lithe and sort of like toned because he's been working on a ship for 3 months.
He's getting
comments
look,
on it in the story.
I mean, look, you know, I'm going to say it, vitamin D exposure, pretty sexy. You know?
I mean, yeah, he takes the hood off and finally you can see a sun, yeah. For sure. I mean, there's a line, my favorite line in this, I mean, there's a few that blow me away, but my favorite one just in terms of really solidifying these two characters together, and it comes off the back of when Vraska witnesses Tezzeret physically torturing Jace for messing up whatever mission he was on for Tezzeret, and bringing up her memories of her abuse at the hands of the Azorius, which indeed kicks off her entire story as being someone who wants to like reunify the Golgari and kind of, you know, bring her clan, her people to the forefront of Ravnican society. And it's the line, no one ever chooses to be a victim. You are not weak because you were taken advantage of, and the cruelty of what they made you do reflects on them, not you. And it's just such a simple, kind thing to say. But it's the only thing that could really have been said to either of them to really show that they have this positive connection and that they can both kind of like walk hand in hand forwards in that. And as well as just, you know, moving past the kind of the idea that the negative things in your life maybe come about fully out of your control. Like you have to do what you have to do to survive. And sometimes that's because of the machinations of people outside of your remit. And yeah, it's an incredible line.
I was just sort of actually like, ooh, brought some tears to my eyes. I'm like, oh, that's so good.
It's real good.
I also one of the other, gosh, I think that there's another line here. I think she, I think as the moment, I think, let's see, after when he is just right after the image of Vryn, it says, she held him for all the times she wished someone had held her when she was imprisoned. She hugged him close for every time she had asked for help and been hit in return. She had spent so much of her life alone and shut away. It was impossible for her to deny comfort to someone who, like her, had suffered such an immensity of hurt. And that, I think, is so... it's amazing. And I think in many ways, perhaps embodies empathy at its core. Right. And I think while empathy, I've always argued, I just realized something. Empathy, I've always thought has been like a very blue trait, but I think it's actually a very blue green trait. Now that I have to think of it, because it not only it's an emotion and it's a, a psychological tendency to not only want to share knowledge about another person's emotions, but it's also a decision to help feel those emotions for yourself. So it's almost like a shared emotional intelligence in a way, which is very, very cool. And also just very like, oh, Vraska. Like she's such a badass, right? Like is so
easily
strong.
One of my favorite characters. Easily one of my favorite characters in this.
Yeah.
In this game.
No, she and Liliana are like, I love the mess that Liliana is, but I also just love Vraska so much as well. what can I say? I love me a black aligned planeswalker lady.
Oh, for sure. I mean, one of our recent favorites on this podcast has been Kaya, and that's, you know, that's completely, you know, down to that color pie philosophy a lot of the time, I think.
Oh, she's so great.
So cool. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one though, because the story of these characters in these moments and these memories isn't just about Jace, and it's not just about Vraska, because they do look at other characters moving through. I mean, you see Liliana as well, and you see her at her maybe, I don't know, she's still in kind of Machiavellian mode, where obviously we're meant to kind of sympathize with Jace, because this is still Liliana kind of manipulating Jace, because he's, you know, puppy dog in love with her at this point still, or at least, you know, the hangover of that is still there. And Vraska as an outside eye can kind of see this is going on. But you do see some vulnerability from Liliana. And even in the character of Al Hamret, who is a complete shitbag, like there's no getting around it. Like, Al Hamret is not a good force for good, like he's an abuser and a torturer and all the horrible things that you'd want, like a pantomime villain or just a straight up asshole, like in a story, like it's quite a traumatic thing, you know, to the, a lot of the stuff that Hammer did to Jace. But even in the moment where Jace it describes him as being a little too hungry to defeat Alhamrat, and he gets the one up on Alhamrat in their psychic duel and crushes his mind. And then the fallout and the aftermath of watching this Sphinx not know how to flap his wings, he doesn't understand where he is, he's breathing as if it's the first time he's ever breathed a breath in his life, and it's the line, there's a line I'm paraphrasing, but it's no one should ever have to go through this, you know, even the worst of the worst shouldn't have to suffer so intently, even if it is suffering in a way that they've made other people suffer. And it's just it shows that these characters, especially people like Jace, who are maybe at times not the most righteous character, or indeed the most tolerable, like Jace as a person can be just infuriating at times and has indeed done horrible things in his past, but he's at his core, he is empathetically good. And it's a fantastic case study of why these people are the heroes of our story, as opposed to just, you know, and just another side character.
Oh, absolutely. It is, I think it dares to go into these individual character psyches at a level that I think we really need to go to again. Mm-hmm. I think that's what makes these, I think a lot of what Magic had been trying to do with its world building at this point was emulating a lot of the comic book model. But when we think about the comic book model, like, I'm not certain how much of a comic book nerd you are, but
I'm pretty au fait with comic books, yeah.
But when we think about like the comic books that stand the test of time, it's the ones that really dig into the character of these heroes, right? Mm. Why they decide to do what they do, who they really are. You know, like, I know people talk about The Long Night for Batman. I think Red Sun is actually a very interesting look into what makes Superman Superman. Mm. And there are a bunch of other and I know Marvel has its own share of really fantastic musings on those topics as well. Mm. But with regards to, you know, Magic's story, this is, I think, where the characters can really, really shine. And I think just the decision to, this is what we really wanted for War of the Spark, right? Like, we had been invested with these characters for such a long time. You know, we actually proceed from the Flood to Dominaria after, and then we see Liliana go through her own issues where she has to put down her brother for the second time. This is, I mean, she's not okay. And I really would have loved to have more insight, like this level of insight into her. We get a little bit of that, right? And you mentioned it with how Vraska sees Liliana through Jace's eyes. Mm. Like, who this person who loves control and power so much, she is willing to do anything to keep, to retain it. Mm. What I would have really loved to see that a little bit more with the subsequent novels, but you know, it is what it is. And what I do love is just the fact that we have this still, right? Like, no matter how terrible things got in the subsequent ones, we still have this to look at and we still have this to come back to.
I mean, I brought you on to be positive about this story because I wanted us to like share in something.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
But no. But what my point is that I'm about to dive into why I think it was so utterly shit, and like with the World of the Spark stuff, like, only because this is so good. That's my point. Us talking about it and me talking with you about this story is just a highlight of how they went. If you take like the Bolas arc, and they this is kind of like the second act, like hero's downfall, if we're looking like at a very sort of like sort of standard, like, oh, you know, hero's journey kind of thing. War of the Spark was meant to be like the redemption into the third act, like victory. And having Amonkhet, Dominaria, then Amonkhet, then Ixalan, and having all these characters go through levels of being broken down and defeated and beaten and, you know, utterly destroyed, we needed that lift up again in the War of the Spark novels. And we never we never got that delivered. They were just very rushed, like, oh, here's a planeswalker, here's a character, here's a character, here's a character. Oh, all the storylines are fine. Here's a bunch of new shit that, you know, you need to kind of wrap your head around as well. We're doing it in two novels or novellas. And it was just, I think it is a testament, and it is fantastic that we still have these, because as you've said a couple of times, this shows just how good writers who are invested in telling actual stories with these characters can be. And like, I always have to remind myself as a Vorthos, like, this is a storyline attached to a card game, but the card game itself promotes the idea of color pie philosophy and ways of being and ways of interacting in its very game mechanics. And so the fact that these stories can keep up with that idea and put them into like narrative, like, function is just such a wondrous thing that little bleak period, well, I say little, that extended bleak period where we had those fucking books, you know, or even some of like, when Sundered Bond and The Wildered Quest came out, I loved the idea that they were bringing in Kate Elliott and Django Wexler to write these novels, but you could tell by reading them, they themselves didn't get the resources to write those books well enough, you know. Yes. And it's just seeing these online stories written by someone who's part of the creative team, is invested in Magic as a job and as like a hobby, and as we all know, this hobby is essentially a lifestyle at times, and seeing these characters grow, it's just absolutely joyous. Even in a story like this, which is very hard, you know, it's not easy subject matter, and yeah, so like positive, like, annoyance through positivity, I suppose. It just reminds me just how fucking awful those books were.
It is absolutely like devastating to just look at them and be like, what? Because this storyline also put a bunch of really fantastic eventual payoffs, right? It create the setup for an eventual payoff, as particularly with Jace and Vraska both Vraska consenting to have Jace erase her memories of what happened, and everyone just be like, oh no, it's so heartbreaking. and then War of the Spark just be like, wait, we just let that, wait, what was the payoff? There was no payoff.
Thank you.
No payoff. Thank what you. Happened? It's like a good joke. You do the setup, and then you have the payoff. But it's, I don't know. I just look back at this and think to myself, like, this, we can make this happen again. I mean, it's just a matter of, again, putting the, like, setting people up well, giving them the resources they need to succeed, giving the writers their chance to shine. I hear you with regards to a lot of the outsourced written material. I think, to my knowledge, like, after this whole series with Alison Lores, I think probably my favorite series of stories for Magic the Gathering so far has been the Ravnica, I think, anthology, basically, I would call it, by Nikki Drayden.
Yes,
she has 10
that was
stories.
Fantastic. Throughout Ravnica Allegiance and Guilds of Ravnica, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That was amazing.
It was amazing. I think the reason why it was amazing was I think Nikki Drayden, I don't know if it was that they gave her everything that she needed or she just succeeded in spite of it. Either way, I think the freedom they allowed her to take with just exploring the world of Ravnica was honestly some of the best work they've ever done. Giving, I think, writers the freedom to really, really put their own take on this particular subject matter is, I think, the key to success for these stories so far. Because we look at that particular anthology, which I'm like, God, I need to get this into a book form or something. It's so good.
It was a really smart decision. It was a really smart decision to do.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that they didn't center any of the main characters, the fact that they were just like, yep, these are just 10 vignettes into the story of 10 people's lives on Ravnica. And I almost wish that they had printed these stories into the D&D Ravnica module, because of any resource out there, I think they are the best in giving any potential DM or anyone interested in this world an idea of what it's like to live in it. like actually live in Ravnica, which turns out kind of sucks. But yeah.
Oh yeah, it would. the prevailing theory on this podcast is that there's almost no plane which you would really want to live on. They all suck in a major way, which is where the conflict obviously comes from. But like,
I mean, I still say Kaladesh is still my favorite because I know for sure they have mangoes.
True. They also have ice, like they have like ice desserts and things like that as well.
Yeah, they have ice desserts. They have like pretty mechas. I think Kamigawa Neon Dynasty is now probably my second choice, but I still, yeah, I love me a mango. We'll go to Kaladesh for it.
Yeah. Anywhere, I mean, isn't it funny that you've spotted the two that are the most technologically advanced? You wouldn't want to go anywhere that's like still dealing with like disease.
I need running water. I'm sorry.
That's reasonable. You don't have to. Yeah.
You know, I have not seen a single faucet on Dominaria. I'm sorry. I'm not going over there. Not until plumbing, I think, is just sort of the basic thing for me. I'm like, I don't want any of this magic nonsense where you magic away your poop. Like, I just want plumbing. I don't know why that's so difficult to ask.
Sanitation, that's right. If a plane has sanitation, then yeah, they can't really do much wrong, I don't think. I think it shows, though, like when the, as you're saying about just having being allowed to put their own spin on it, because you can see it. You can see it. Like we saw it with Chaos Noel Rivera, when they were doing the Crimson Vow and Midnight Hunt storylines. They're a massive Magic fan. They actively play Magic, and you could see it in the writing. Even though the stories themselves were fine. Like, not here to review them. Already done that. But like the actual, you could see the joy in those stories, and you can see it here as well, which is why.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so amazing. Allison really cares about these characters.
Allison is a wonderful human being, and I love her to death, and we are good friends. I the thing too that I've been loving about some of the more recent writers being brought in, like K.R. Arsenal Rivera, as well as Nikki Drayden, is, and I think to some extent Kate Elliott as well, with the Bolas arc.
Yes.
She's a mother to twins, so she's got this.
Yeah.
Like, she's gonna. Bolas and Ugin's origin story, you know, she has insights, she knows she has things, and that's the thing too, just like, and also I know that, you know, we give her a little bit of flack for the World Request, but having marginalized people come forward and tell their interpretations of Magic story is, I think, incredibly powerful. Well, the War Games did an interview with Nikki Drayden, particularly about her Golgari story, which featured a crawl basically going and being part of a competition in order to like get a certain position, and how they were like, how the Golgari, who are supposed to be, you know, more egalitarian, were like, well, we can't have a crawl win, so we're gonna have an elf also be here. And she said that she took that directly from a story in the Times about a Black valedictorian whose school was absolutely just weirded out by that idea, and so decided to also have a white valedictorian. So that kind of perspective of intersectionality, what it's like to be a mother, what it's like to have twins, what it's like to be a person of color, and in K. Arsenal's case, like in a queer person of color, like that's fantastic. You know, I love the reintroduction of Chandra's disaster crushes. and this is just what we need. We need more of this.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely agreed. I mean, it just goes to show that these stories, far from just being a marketing tool to push a game, actually do have merit and do have gravitas. And you can either choose to treat it just like buy our toy, or you can choose to treat it like we're going to treat our audience with a bit of respect, because this game is played by people all over the world in all different countries from all different like backgrounds, and you need to respect the game. Like, the Magic the Gathering is the gathering. And that's not just about your LGS, even though that's important. It's about who centers around these stories.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, if we give chess... I mean, Magic the Gathering is just as complicated as chess. And if chess can have a musical, then I think we should take Magic the Gathering more seriously. I say that realizing now that some people may not necessarily like the ABBA-written music of chess. But I mean, you know, if we are allowed to give this one game this amount of respect, I think that Magic the Gathering, it's only a matter of time, I think, before we see this game also I think hopefully appreciated and respected on the same level. That's my hope anyway.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's on its way there for definite. I mean, the money does talk and the money is there. So now there's only the narrative that needs to catch up, and it's doing a good job at the moment. I'm still not out of the weeds of trusting it fully, but you can't deny that the past few story arcs since they've brought back online fiction has only been getting better and better in mm-hmm. every single way.
Absolutely. So, yeah. And I think it says a lot too that I think that the upwards momentum in Magic story is also just a reflection of the fact that Wizards is listening, mm-hmm. That they've gotten the message, and that they are actually putting in more time and people into making sure that Magic story is good. And the demand is there, and I'm happy that they're finally taking the time to meet it.
Agreed. Nice. Well, there we are. I mean, awesome. End on a positive note for a story that we're so positive about. I love it. I absolutely love it. You sold yourself very short, by the way, when you said like you were introducing yourself. Recently, you've been... I just want to poke you about it because I'm a fan of the media. Okay, like, you've been doing DM work for Loading Ready Run, and you've also been on Magic with Zuby playing D&D with Zuby.
Yes, yes. I don't mean to sell myself short on purpose. It's a matter of just like, oh God, I don't know. It's also just tricky. I admit I'm working on this in therapy, just like coming to a point where I can discuss my credentials without feeling like I'm taking up space.
Sure.
In a way that might offend others. And so thank you for calling me out on that.
I'm personally a massive fan of Loading Ready Run. Zuby is a friend of the channel. Like,
Zuby is amazing. I've been getting into the TTRPG space like no one's business. And so I've been doing DM work. Last year I did Queer as Hell for Loading Ready Run. I worked together really closely with Kathleen on that. And then I'm hoping to do something later this year with Loading Ready Run again. And I do appear on their streams from time to time. I play Jackbox and try to understand the games on there to varying amounts of success.
It's on their Crossing the Streams streams, right?
Yes, it's Crossing the Streams. Yeah. We do Jackbox. And I'm just like, I hope I can be funny on demand. And yeah, I've been doing Price of the Progress with Zuby, where I play Karen, who is an Emerald Dragonborn barbarian, suburban mother of three, who's a retired adventurer, and due to a multi-level marketing company completely destroying her romance book club, she has decided to take to the road and basically just rip them apart, going up the chain, as it were, trying to see getting to the bottom of this whole thing, because, you know, pyramid schemes are the worst. And I have to say, the energy I try to bring to Karen is very much, I don't know if you've seen the clip of two women fighting at the Bath and Body Works.
No, I'm not familiar with it, but I can imagine.
I mean, Karen is basically, I think, I'm just trying to channel Karen energy as much as possible. I have to admit, it is tricky sometimes trying to pretend to be that entitled.
We have Karens in the UK as well, don't worry. We're all very familiar.
There's a lot of just like, I try my best whenever I get into character to like focus on a single phrase in order to kind of lock me in. And the one I use is for Karen is, can I speak to your manager?
Perfect. But yeah. Well, yeah. Well, I mean, anyone who's listening to this podcast episode will know that we've guested on Zuby streams many a time. So if you like our podcast, you probably already listened to Zuby's as well, and are probably already aware that Michelle's been guesting on the D&D stuff as well. But if you haven't seen it, do check it out. And of course, Loading Ready Run needs zero introduction. I'm sure you've seen Michelle on the streams there. But yeah, I think that's almost us for the time being. Other than the kind of current projects that you're on, what are the social medias that people can find you on to kind of witness the tour de force that is you and your space in the magic world?
That's very kind. Oh gosh. Well, you can find me on Twitter, where I mostly, like I mentioned before, I try to practice responsible spiciness with regards to topics out there. I mostly yell about feminism and you know, representation, media representation of people of color, social mm-hmm. justice, as well as my cats and my pottery. And occasionally a lot of bread. I do bake often. So there's just, you know, if you're just content warning, if you're like, oh, I can't with focaccia right now, like my stream, my feed may just be just bread.
For sure. I mean, anyone who's like familiar with the content that Nathan and I have been putting out for the past 2 years, if any of those times where there has been discourse about a lot of the different isms in the magic space, especially when it comes to things like race and background, a lot of our times where we very openly said, as two pasty white London boys, we have our opinion, but actually, to be honest, we're going to defer to this kind of larger discourse. Guess where we got our discourse from, ladies and gentlemen, and everyone in between, is Michelle Rapp.
Because, oh, that's very kind.
But it's also true, because I think our audience is pretty well on the same page. So I think I'm preaching to the choir when I say that, you know, it's just, you have to listen as well as, like, shout. So, yeah, all those times where we've gone, this is what people are saying, we're inclined to believe the people who are saying it, then it's more than likely been Michelle, well, as well as a few other names. But yes, you can find us and our own opinions, and indeed us listening to the opinions of others, on Twitter at mtflavoring. Emails can go to mtflavoring@gmail.com. Nathan's personal Twitter is at the Fox in the Moon, and my personal Twitter is at Andy Manface. Michelle, thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute joy.
Yes, thank you so much for having me on. It's been wonderful. I'd be happy to come back on and do it again.
Oh, absolutely. Don't you worry. I'll be pestering you no end. Well, all that remains for me to say is thank you so much for listening. This has been Magic Flavoring.